more time, says, "Thus saith Yahweh, stand by the ways and see and ask for the ancient paths, for the ancient paths, where the good way is, and walk in it, and you shall find rest for your souls." How many of you want rest for your souls? Especially in this day and age, there's so much turmoil around us. Our rest, of course, is in the Messiah and His blood redemption from the cross and His resurrection from the grave. But let me tell you, a part of that rest and that peace comes from seeking and restoring the ancient paths. For those of you that are not in the Tate Ministry, this will be Restoring the Ancient Landmarks Part 2, with yesterday's message being Part 1. For those of you on the Tate Ministry, this is actually Part 5. For anyone who signs up on the Tate Ministry, I'll try to remember to catch you up. We've already sent out two of the tapes. We'll be sending out these two messages probably in the next mailing. So we're over here at table that's there was a sign up, it'd be mission to Israel. Let me assure you, that's not a mission to go back to Palestine to rebuild the temple, but a mission to Israel, as we understand, or many of us do understand who she is. Again, this will be Part 5, and as I mentioned in yesterday's message, that I'm not sure, particularly with this message, I really have no idea how long this is going to be. Again, it'll probably, as it already has been, interspersed with different messages as it becomes necessary to do so. But I want you to know, some of you complain about me having long series. Cut it out. Because just be thankful you're not getting John Weaver's long series. It took me 14 messages to cover Hosea. It took him 78. Now, you talk about a long series. But I'll guarantee every one of them was good, as you can tell from what you've already been able to enjoy from his messages. The previous message was aimed at the next generation. Or more precisely, at this generation, catching a vision for the next generation and the generations to follow. Specifically in regards to taking dominion, if by no other means, and it's certainly not the only means, but if by no other means, taking dominion by our sheer numbers. I provided you in the last message with a hypothetical Wyland population explosion. I pointed out to you how if each of my four children, which again, for those of you who weren't here, this wasn't just hypothetical in the sense that I literally told them, I want each of you to have eight children so that I get 32 grandchildren. And by the end of six generations, that would amount to 131,072 Wylands. Now, a generation is usually considered to be about 40 years, so that's 131,072 Wylands in 240 years. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, that doesn't really sound like all that much in that amount of time. But we're only talking about Wylands. What if thousands of our people were to catch that same vision? And I pointed, for those of you who weren't here, I pointed out, we are at a crisis point as a people. We are no longer even replacing ourselves as a whole. Less than two children per couple is the average right now. What if we were to change that completely around? Think about it. If thousands of our people were to do the same thing. And listen, unless you want to be overrun with violence. And let me tell you, the Boatwrights and the Rotans, if you know Tom and Susie and their bunch, who I'd have mentioned yesterday as well had I known they were in the audience, and the Nailers already have a big jump on the rest of us. So keep that in mind. If you don't want to be overrun by them or us, then some of the rest of you had better catch that same vision for yourselves and for your children. Why shouldn't we have such a vision? Why should we fall for these traps and these designs, these conspiracies, Rush Limbaugh, that people have against our people? We're the only ones who fall for them, like I pointed out in the last message. We're the gullible ones. You better also catch the vision for yourselves as well, because you want to know how many Wylands there will be if we add just one more generation to the equation? Listen to this. It grows exponentially. Have you ever heard the story about the horse? If you take, what would you rather have? A penny, or excuse me, $1,000 or $10,000 or some figure like that, or a penny doubled for every nail in a horse in a horse in every one of his four shoes. How many of you know? I forget what the figure is because I didn't have it in my notes, but it's most people say $10,000. What are you crazy? But if you double, starting with a penny for the first nail, by the time you've reached all 32 nails, it's in the millions of dollars that you'll have received. It grows in not quite the same way, but it grows exponentially. If we had just one more generation of Wylands with the same vision of their children, of course it's hypothetical because there won't be eight for every child, but I hope there is. I don't want any of you to beat me in this race. But in seven generations, or 280 years, there will be 1,048,576 of us. Now think about that. Scary, isn't it? That's not what I mean. But you do think about it. You know, are we losing our country today? Well, let me tell you something. It's just Christian Israel alone. Just Christian Israel alone could take this country back in a rally. And we have to take it back for Christ. Don't confuse the physical number part of this, that we can ever do it by the arm of the flesh alone. And that's why I say, if Christian Israel alone could take this country back in a relatively short amount of time, if we would only catch the vision. A vision for our children, our families, our communities, and our country. A vision for the kingdom. A vision for Christian Israelite dominion once again. Not only are we being robbed of what's rightfully ours by simply being out-reproduced, certainly other ways as well, but they're right now, that's where it's really coming down to it. We're simply being out-produced. But we are also being dispossessed of what is ours by a tidal wave of aliens via illegal and quote-unquote legal immigration. And if you don't believe it, consider the following Chicago Tribune newspaper article. I don't have the date on this. And by the way, if you send me articles, please send me the name of the newspaper and the date. Somehow include that with me so that I can document it when I do use the material. I appreciate all that you send to me. Sometimes I will not use it for years. It goes into a file, but oftentimes it will be used sometime down the road, and I do need the documentation. It was from a Chicago Tribune newspaper article entitled "Immigrants Stir Melting Pot, Rooster Blood Courts Don't Mix." Here's just a part of it. The United States, long a largely white European melting pot, is becoming more multicultural. These new immigrants sometimes have difficulty in dealing with our courts. The nations they hail from lack roots in the, listen to this, it's quite an admission. It's amazing. If I was to say this, I'd be attacked as a white supremacist or some right-wing radical. But if the media says it, it's no problem at all. It's a great admission. Again, it says, these new immigrants sometimes have difficulty in dealing with our courts. The nations they hail from lack roots in the Christian tradition that forms the political and philosophical foundation of our government. Quite an admission. Going on, accommodation of cultural mores rather than the law may be consideration in defining criminal blame. But it becomes an excuse for breaking the law that affects our basic concepts of right and wrong. A little bit later, it says this, quoting a Jim Dater, a political scientist of the University of Hawaii and a futurist, he said this, quote within a quote, "Nothing will be more rare in the future than a white person, and nothing may be less important than the white man's ways." End of that quote. Within a quote by Jim Dater. That is just not a possibility. That is the road. That is the treadmill that we are currently on. Now, once again, it's not the white man's ways in and of themselves that's what's important. It's what, obviously, even from this mediaite, he admits it, what comes with the white man because of who he is. Because he's the man who the new covenant was made with. or at least part of that group of people, was whom the new covenant was made with. In Hebrews 10, you know, it's interesting that there are so many churches across this land that claim to be New Testament churches. And what they're saying is that they're a new covenant church. And yet they don't know the two most basic things about the covenant: who the covenant was made with and what the covenant is. And it's as clear as a bell in Hebrews 8, 8 through 10. But the new covenant was made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And there is absolutely no way under this, under God's heaven and sun, that that can be spiritualized, because verse 9 then tells us, like the covenant that was made with their fathers who was led out of Egypt at the time of Moses. I mean, physical descendants. I spiritualized that for years. And all of a sudden, somebody said, well, read verse 9, Ted. Read verse 9. And that can't be spiritual. They're physical descendants. Not only do they not know who the new covenant was made with, they don't know what the new covenant is. Because verse 10, it says it's the laws that's written on their hearts. We are a people who naturally understand. We may not obey as a people, but we understand God's law. It's natural to us. You ask the average man walking down, the white man walking down the street, what's the right and the wrong of the Ten Commandments, they'll tell you. They may not be doing it, but they know, because it's written on their heart. Whereas you ask an Indian or a Japanese person or something like that, and you may get a totally different answer if they haven't been influenced by the white culture. So it's not important that it's the white man. It's what God has given the white man to take to the rest of the world. But worse yet, contemplate the following May 28, 1994 Des Moines Register article entitled "Too Caucasian, Iowa's Image Too White," says Grandy. Well, who's this Grandy fella anyway? You know, just some far-out left-wing kook that the media dug off the corner of some street? Well, let me assure you, he's a left-wing kook all right, but he wasn't some bum off the corner street. Here's how part of the article continues. It says, quote, U.S. Representative Fred Grandy said Friday that the next governor should, quote, lend the charge, end quote, to make Iowa a more diverse state and to help Iowans become more tolerant of non-white cultures. I don't even necessarily have a problem with that, as long as it's their culture where they belong. Grandy, who is challenging incumbent Terry Branstad for the Republican nomination. Don't tell me there's any difference between these guys. What was it? Somebody said that you put the two together and you got Republic rats. Grandy, who is challenging incumbent Terry Branstad for the Republican nomination for governor in the primary election June 7th, told a radio talk show Friday he wanted, quote, within a quote, a new kind of image for Iowa, end of quote, within a quote. Continuing, he said, upon taking office, I would be looking for those qualified individuals that would represent a new kind of image for Iowa and who could be out advocating for Iowa and presenting a different image for this state, which, as ABC News anchor Ted Koppel, great authority, has said, is predominantly white and polite. End of his quote. Oh, it's bad to be white and polite. We may be white, we're any more even hardly polite. Read the Scottish Chiefs, and you'll be ashamed of what our culture has digressed to. He could left off the polite. Going on, Grandy said, quote, we have to acknowledge that we are, to some degree, a very kind of isolated and atypical state in this union because we are too predominantly Caucasian. He said he would use the bully pulpit of the governorship to promote diversity in Iowa's multicultural heritage, end of quote, within a quote, and end of quote. You know, I wonder if such race traitors, and yes, I did say race traitors, you know, it's all right for the blacks to talk about race traitors, and it's all right for the Indians to talk about race traitors, but we've got them too. And it's just as right for us to say it as it is for them to say it. I wonder if such race traitors have any idea what the consequences of such designs to de-whiten this nation will amount to. I carry a book on our book list entitled The Dispossessed Majority by Wilmot Robertson. How many have read that book? Pretty amazing book. It was published, first published in 1972, and on page 538 he wrote this, quote, "History is insistent in pointing out that when the dominant population group goes, the country goes. As is daily becoming more apparent, the dying fall of the American majority is the dying fall of America itself." End of his quote. And again, not because of who we are, but because of who he is and the fact that he is to be our God. And he is the one that gives us our culture and our morals. The dispossessed majority. That is indeed precisely what we are very quickly becoming, at least until we decide to do something about it. But let me tell you, before we can win back the hearts and the minds of our people, which is where this series originally started, that's where the restoration process starts with. I asked the audience when I first preached the first message of that series, and all kinds of ideas where this restoration has to begin. We have to win by winning the hearts and the minds of our people back. But even before that, if we're going to do that, we have got to win back the pulpits of America. The Bible, specifically the Old Testament, often speaks of the high places of Baal and Ashtaroth and the other gods of the peoples of the lands, the countries around Israel, which the Israelites were expressly commanded to tear down, to remove. In other words, there was no pluralism in God's plan or scheme of things. They were to tear down those idols. They were to tear down those temples. They were to remove it from the land. And of course, they didn't, and they suffered the consequences. That term high places, although very common in the Old Testament, is found one time in the New Testament. I'd like you to turn to the passage. It's Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. And I am trying to hurry, Norm. Chapter 6 and verse 10, which says, finally, beginning with verse 10, it says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand therefore, having so forth and so on." Verse 12 again ends by saying, or verse 12, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against powers, against the rulers, against the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." Now that passage is usually interpreted by the vast majority of Judeo-Christianity as being a description of a battle waged against the devil and his demons. But let me suggest to you an alternative, or at least an additional interpretation of that passage. Let me point something out to you that, in case you haven't figured it out yet. We have today devils and principalities and rulers and spiritual wickedness in high places today, other than Satan and his demons. Now, of course, when the word devil is found employed in the Scriptures, most Christians automatically think of Satan, that quote-unquote fallen angel or demon of darkness. You might want to address him as that character that so many Christians are so concerned about in their Christian walk. However, the Greek word diabolos, from which the English word devil is quote-unquote translated, more of a transliteration than a translation, not always in the New Testament is rendered as devil. How many knew that? Not always devil. Some of you, okay. Did you know that in three New Testament locations, that word is accurately translated? In 1 Timothy 3:11, it's translated as slanderer. And in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 3, and in Titus chapter 2 and verse 3, it's translated as false accusers. You can look on it on your own. For some of you, that's going to be, I purposely didn't want to quote it or go to it, because I want you, since I know some of you have never heard this before, you better check this preacher out and see if it's not the case. You go get a Greek lexicon and find out if that's not the Greek word diabolos translated in that fashion in those three passages. And in all three locations, Diabolos has nothing to do with a quote-unquote fallen angel or some big daddy demon of darkness. I guarantee you. Now, is it just me? Because it seems to me that we have a false accuser and a slanderer right now in a high place. You know, that poor misunderstood fella up there that is really not guilty of anything and always slandering someone else. You know, it's that white ring conspiracy that caused me to do that. You know who I'm talking about? Doesn't he qualify as a diabolos, a false accuser, in a high place? How about the word principalities found in this particular passage in Ephesians chapter 6? How is that word used today? Principalities. What do you think of when you think of principalities? Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary defines it in the following fashion. Number one definition, the state, office, and or authority of a prince or a ruler, president. That's a principality. Titus 3:1 also employs that word. Puts it this way, put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates, to be ready for every good work. Word powers, found also in Ephesians 6. I just read it to you in Titus 3. That word powers is also found in Romans chapter 3 and verse 1, where it says, let every soul be subject to the higher powers. For there is no power but of God, the powers that be are ordained of God. And for those of you who don't know better, let me tell you that those two passages are not telling you that you have to submit to all government authority. If you don't believe me, read the excellent book by John Weaver. What's the title of it? I forget. Christian and Civil Government. It's over there. I highly recommend it. I've got a copy of a book on the same subject called Christian Duty Under Corrupt Government, a revolutionary commentary on Romans 13, 1 through 7. That's not, even though that's how it's often being taught, that is not what those passages are saying. But that's off point here. The point being is that it shows us how these terms are used in the Scriptures. Ephesians 6:12 again says, for we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers. Note, the word rulers is not singular, it's plural. Against rulers, and then it says the rulers of the darkness of the world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. The word darkness is the Greek word skotos. Strong's definition, though always not the best, but Strong's definition provides this. Quote, from the base of 4639, listen to this, shadiness, that is obscurity. Shadiness and obscurity. I don't know about you, but it sounds like pretty good terms and description of what's going on Capitol, or what I prefer to call Crime Hill. And did I say hill? Is not a hill a high place? We were there in 19, several ministers in 19, I think it was 1989, were there, and we walked the halls of Congress and were trying to deal with some of the congressmen and senators and mostly their aides. One of the issues I remember was dealing with some of the gun confiscation legislation that they were trying to pass. There were other issues as well, and I don't remember. Does anybody know, is that actually built on a hill? I can't recall if there was a hill there or not. Excuse me? Seven, yeah, there are hills. I've come to think of it. People, at least I've heard people say that. I don't remember if that's the case, but did you know this? That Capitol Hill used to be known, originally was known as Jacob's Hill. How many knew that? One of the wives of one of the ministers that was, as we were walking through the halls of Congress, was taking one of the tour rides, and the tour bus guy shared that. They said this originally was known as Jacob's Hill. Another part of our history they seem to have hidden from us and tried to rob from us. But anyway, are you getting the picture? Christians are indeed in a battle with spiritual wickedness in high places, at least when the wicked rule. We shouldn't be when the wicked don't rule, but when the wicked rule, we're in a battle with wickedness in high places. The diabolos, the devil, that the Apostle Peter admonished Christians to resist, not submit to, but the diabolos, the devil, that Peter admonished Christians to resist in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8 and 9, let me tell you, was not some demon of darkness, but was instead that devil Nero. And I deal with that in Christian Duty Under Corrupt Government. For those of you who may not be familiar with that, and we don't have time to go there, because that's not even the point of this message. But moreover, just think about this as well. In every single biblical example provided to us in Hebrews chapter 11, it wasn't some quote-unquote fallen angel with whom the battle was being waged. But it was instead another type of wickedness in high places. Consider Moses and Pharaoh, or Joshua and Jericho. And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of the fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, and put foreign armies to flight. End of quote, Hebrews 11, 32 through 34. Hebrews 11:6 says, and most all of Christendom can quote this verse, Hebrews 11:6, and without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who draws near to God must believe that he exists and that he's a rewarder of those who seek him. They can quote it. All kinds of Christians today can quote that verse, but they fail to realize that that verse is sandwiched by all of these examples of the kind of faith that he says we must have to please him. The kind of faith described in that last passage. And it goes on to say, of whom this world is not worthy. Turn. Or also consider the apostles in the book of Acts, particularly Acts 4 and 5. You know, what kind of wickedness in high places were they battling? Or consider the saints in Fox's Book of Martyrs. Every single one of them indeed wrestled, fought with spiritual wickedness in high places. But it wasn't some quote-unquote fallen angel. Nevertheless, let me tell you something else. We are not in the fix that we find ourselves in today because of that high place of politics called Capitol Hill, but rather because of America's high places behind the pulpits. Now, don't be mistaken. Capitol Hill is a high place of religion. Politics is all about religion. However, I'm referring to those other high places of religion, the pulpits of America's churches. Isn't it true that the pulpits, just like we have here today, are usually set up on a higher platform? Preachers look down upon the audience. There's a purpose in that as well, but nonetheless, it's a higher place. And even if that wasn't the case, not in my church, but even if there wasn't a platform of some type elevating the preacher, it makes no difference because most ministers in America have elevated themselves by demanding a homage that is due only to God by calling themselves or allowing themselves to be called reverend, a term that's only used one time in the entire Bible, Psalms 111 and verse 9, and it's in reference to Yahweh. Don't call me reverend. I'm not reverend. There's only one who is. He is. We're just his servants. Now, let me assure you, we are in the fix that we are in because of the high places of religions, because of the pulpits in America's churches today. And let me also assure you that those high priests and priestesses in that high place known as Capitol Hill could never get away with what they do if it wasn't for the high crimes committed by the priests behind their high pulpits in America's churches. If we had men today like those who filled the pulpits in the early 1600s and 1700s, how many of you heard? I sent it out a couple of years ago on the tape ministry, and if If you didn't hear it then, let me tell you, you need to get it. How many have heard John's message on the black-robed regiment? Man, you tell you, well, you want to be thrilled. What a message. I encourage you to purchase a copy of that if you didn't get a chance to listen to it. But if we had that type of men once again behind America's pulpits, I'll guarantee you that there wouldn't have been any need to have a discussion or a debate or whatever they want to call it about in the impeachment of the president. He'd have never, with those kinds of men behind the pulpit, let me guarantee you, he'd have never been elected president in the first place. Amen. And by the way, I don't know about you, but I wasn't for President Clinton resigning. Were you? Was anybody here for him resigning? But let me tell you this. I also, no brother, you haven't got it right yet. I wasn't for impeaching him either. No, I was for stoning him. Adultery and who knows what else is not an impeachment offense, it's a stoning offense. And let me tell you, when we come back, we're not going back to hanging, we're not going back to electrocutions, we're not going to guillotines, we're going back to stoning. There's a reason for that. I've got an article going up on the web page here shortly, for those of you that have internet access, that'll explain the reasons why it has to be stoning. It's necessary. God doesn't make any mistakes. You know, he could have hung him back then or shot. If he wanted to do it in a more humane way, he'd have shot an arrow through him or something. He did it for stoning. That man needs to be stoned, not impeached. But I'm getting away from where I want to go with this message, even though that was fun. The point being, in order for us to win back, to restore the minds and the hearts of our people, we need to restore. We need to pray for the ministers of this land. Let me tell you, if anybody needs to pray for it, we need to pray for those in the high place up on Capitol Hill, but we need to pray for the ministers that God would open their hearts and minds. Pray for this one. I've got things I'm blind to. I need to have my mind and my heart open to things that I've got wrong too. I like to point this out. Many of you, if you're on the tape ministry, you're going to hear it several times, but there ain't a one of us, excuse the English, there ain't a one of us that ain't a false teacher. John Weaver's a false teacher. Mike Peebles is a false teacher. I'm a false teacher. Now, there's intentional false teachers and there's non-intentional false teachers. But there's only one that's got perfect doctrine, so that all puts us in the same boat in one regard or the other. Pray for your preachers. Pray for those who you don't even necessarily like, because they need our prayers. We need to win back, and we need to restore the pulpits in America. For example, and this is just one example out of hundreds or maybe thousands that could be used. But today America is literally being overrun with not only non-white immigrants, but also, and more tragically, with their religions and with their gods. By means of the promotion of this thing known as multiculturalism, which is probably promoted nowhere more adamantly than from the majority of the pulpits of America today. And I'm going to use some names. If you don't like it, then you take up the problem with the Apostle Paul and some of the others who used names when it was appropriate to use names. Billy Graham, for example, wrote an article, we'll come back to in a minute, entitled, "We Are All Equal Before God." Institutes of Creation Research, which I think they have some stuff that's very useful. And a little daily reading deal that they have called Days of Praise. Henry Morris wrote an article. It was called All Nations of Men, and in that it began in this fashion. Quote, "This important truth was preached by Paul to the Greek intellectuals in Athens, reminding them and us that all nations are alike before God." End of that quote. And both articles quote Acts 17 and verse 26 as their biblical justification for such statements. Excuse me, Billy Graham only quoted half of it. Because I think even Billy Graham knew if he quoted all of it, that maybe somebody would catch on that he wasn't preaching what the verse actually taught. Here's the Graham article. Actually, it's one of those question-answer things. "Dear Dr. Graham, do you think our country is solving its racial problems? Do you think we need more laws to fight against racial prejudice? Mrs. YN. Dear Mrs. YN, in many ways our country has made substantial progress in solving racial problems in my experience, but there is much to be done. Compared with the past, There certainly has been much progress. When I was a young boy growing up on a farm in the American South, racial segregation was the norm, and few people ever thought it would or even should be changed. As I grew older, and particularly after I became a Christian and began to study the Bible seriously to see what it said about racial segregation, I began to realize that those old ways of thinking need to be changed. Let me read that to you again. I began to realize that those old ways of thinking need to be changed. Jeremiah 6 and verse 16. Behold and look for the ancient paths where the good way is. Somebody's wanting to remove our ancient past. Going on, he said, the Bible makes it clear that God, quote, made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, end of quote, quoting Acts 17 and verse 26. Now, we're going to get to Acts 17, 26 in the next message, because we'll continue with this. But here's another one. This is Signs of the Times, the front cover, it actually is the front cover of a Signs of the Times magazines, which is put out by the Seventh-day Adventists. And I don't know how many of you back there can see what's on it, but it's a picture of two little children. I would say they're both either about 3 or 4 years old. One black and one white. You tell me, for those of you who can't see what it is, you tell me what gender the black is. It's a boy, as it always is. You know, I mean, this is worse than it always is. Because the media is always promoting this all over the place. They can't have a parade without having two hosts, one black man and one white woman, continually trying to shove it down our throats. But here is what's supposed to be a Christian organization that is promoting it at the age of 3 or 4. And the title of the cover is How to Raise Colorblind Kids. Let me tell you there. They're pandering to the blacks is what they're doing. We're the gullible ones and we're following for it, but they're pandering to the blacks. But what the blacks need to know is that they're being used as cannon fodder just like we are. Because let me tell you, this kind of thing destroys their race just as much as it destroys our race. Also, have you noticed around Christmas time that you can't find or see anywhere a nativity scene now, these days, without one of the wise men being black? Have you ever noticed that? Well, let me show you, that's not the worst of it. Somebody this last Christmas season sent me a newspaper article from Minnesota, the Rochester, Minnesota Post Bulletin of December 1998, entitled Nativity Diversity. Here's part of it. Quote, Rochester's growing diversity will be represented in a nativity scene being created as at Assisi. In this creche, Joseph is American Indian, Mary is Southeast Asian, and the infant Jesus is East Indian. The three kings are African, Hispanic, and European. Actually, quote within a quote, we have two kings and a queen. End of quote, within a quote, said Joanne Wagon, director of communications for the Sisters of Franciscans. The woman member is Polish. Quote, within a quote, we wanted to be inclusive. End of quote, within a quote, said Sister Marlis Jacks, who heads the design team. The group also is fashioning a homeless woman and a shepherd boy with Down syndrome. End of quote. Uh-oh. You know, this is sounding more and more like a politically incorrect message. Matter of fact, it's kind of sounding even pulpit incorrect. And let me tell you, there are going to be people that possibly may hear this message. There may be some people here. We've always had new people in the group. This, because of the brainwashing that has happened, not only from secular America, but from the pulpits of America, are going to think, in fact, this is sounding terrible. What did Isaiah say in Isaiah 5? They call evil good and good evil and sweet bitter and bitter sweet. Man, if there was ever a day that's being fulfilled, and it's today. Forget getting done early, I think, Norm. I'm trying. It's going to concern some folks, but you know why? It's because they are more concerned with being PC, politically correct, pulpit correct, preacher correct, all of which anymore pretty much represent the same views. They're more interested in being PC than they are in being BC, biblically correct. Or GC, God correct or Yahweh correct. You know, instead of worrying about what the politicians think or what public opinion is or what even some preacher thinks, we should be concerned with what God thinks, what His opinions are. Forget public opinion. It's just another God of the people. We need to be concerned what His opinion is. And so what do you think Yahweh thinks of multiculturalism? Well, don't forget that Yahweh does not change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Specifically, that's talking about His morals. By the way, if you ever come across somebody who doesn't believe in the law, ask him what the essence of God is outside of love. Well, isn't the essence of God His morality? And where is His morality found? In His laws. So anyone who wants to change His laws wants to change His morality, and thus anybody who wants to change His morality wants to change His God. He doesn't change. He doesn't forget. So, I guess, if we were to find out that He was concerned about multiculturalism yesterday, then He would also have to be, we'd have to conclude that He's also concerned about multiculturalism today. Right? So, did multiculturalism concern Him yesterday? You better believe it did. Turn with me quickly to Leviticus 20, and I'll just read it as I get there, just for the sake of time. Leviticus chapter 20, and beginning with verse 22. In fact, the way this is turning, you'll beat me there. Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 22. Can't read this. You shall therefore keep all of my statutes and my judgments and do them, that the land whither I bring you to dwell therein spew you not out. Let me tell you, are we not a people that's being spewed out of our land that's been given to us? Well, you know the reason why. Because we're failing as a people to keep His laws. Verse 23, and you shall not walk in the manner. You could have replaced that with the customs or the culture of the nations which I cast out before you, for they committed all these things, and therefore I abhorred them. So much for multiculturalism, multi-mannerism, if you want to call it that. Verse 24, but I have said unto you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it unto you to possess it, a land that floweth with milk and honey. I am Yahweh your God, which have separated, you could put segregated there, separated or segregated you from other people. So much for integration. I'm going to skip it. Deuteronomy 23 is another passage that declares to us the same thing. Let me guarantee it declares to us that God doesn't view all nations the same. That there is a particular nation, as I'm sure most of you are aware, that He has chosen to be, as He describes it in His Word, His special treasure. And people get upset with that and say, well, then He's prejudiced. You better believe He is, just like I am when it comes to my wife, and you husbands better be thankful I am. Because I don't think you want me loving your wife the same way I love my wife. So I ask you, who are you going to believe? The likes of Moses or the likes of Billy Graham and Henry Morris and other men, in many ways who are good men. I'm not so sure about Billy, but men who are still blind. But I ask you, who are you going to believe? Those who promote multiculturalism or a God who says, I was concerned yesterday? And we'll see in the next message, He's concerned today as well in the New Covenant with multiculturalism. It's against His design plan for all peoples, not just us. Not just us. Think about this. If segregation was as bad as so many want to make it today, even from the pulpits, why then would Yahweh prophesy that not only would Israel, but everyone would once again be segregated? Listen to this very quickly. Isaiah 13, 12 through 14. I will make a man more precious than fine gold, even a man than the golden wedge of Ophir. Verse 14. They shall every man turn to his own people and flee every one to his own land. End of quote. If it's so bad, as so many want to make it, why would God tell us He's going to segregate us in the future? Let me tell you, it is true that America is becoming has become a melting pot. But let me tell you this, in so doing, it has also become a pressure cooker. That's very close to blasting off its lid. I'll have more to say on this in the next message, and actually, as for those on the tape ministry, it'll continue to the next one as well. But suffice it to say that at this point, that part, not just a part, but part of what we need to restore is racial pride, racial purity, and racial segregation. And that restoration, brothers and sisters, needs to start in the pulpits of America. But if they refuse, we'll just have to do it without them. Amen?
Amen.
Thank you.